Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 234 of the Asuna Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard. Is one of the most important voices of the Second Amendment, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
So by the time you hear this, you're not going to have much time to vote. So please vote for me. And by the way, I don't think I mentioned this the last time. A friend of mine noticed a very odd quirk in the Gundy website. And that is, if you click on vote for me and then you hit the back button, you can vote for me again. You can vote for me 15 times. There are some people who are saying that, well, that's cheating. And it's like, well, I honestly don't know if maybe they meant to do it this way or not. If my friend figured it out, other people from other fans, basically people voting for the other people, might also have figured this out. I just consider this leveling the playing field. So, you know, if you want to vote for me 15 times a day, you can do that. I would like to go to Texas and do something with a tank, please. They probably won't let me drive it. If I'm lucky, they might let me shoot it. I don't know, but I want to go to Texas and do tank things.
They let Matt from Demolition Ranch drive one. He actually jumped it, too.
Oh, no.
The video from inside the tank was pretty horrifying. They jumped it through an RV.
So I just discovered something recently about tanks. I mean, I don't consider myself an absolute gun nerd, but this is something I didn't know. So the M1 Abrams tank, all right, this part I did know, but I'm assuming, Weird, that you don't know this. So forgive me for assuming that you're an idiot. I'm sure that there are going to be some listeners who don't know this. But the M1 Abrams tank is an incredibly fast vehicle for an armored tank. Little tanks are armored, an armored vehicle. And the reason for this is because it has a literal jet engine in it. Now, I don't mean like jet exhaust like a plane, but it is a jet turbine. It runs on jet fuel that gives it power. And for the longest time, I thought that the top speed of an M1 Abrams tank was 45 miles an hour, which for an armored vehicle is fast. Because those things are usually pretty slow. And it's like, okay, you can get up to near highway speeds. That's disturbing. Especially since they've got this really freaky computer-controlled gyroscope. I don't really know how to describe it. But the point being is that as they're bounding along and they're going, you know, up bumps and down hills and whatever, that barrel remains constantly level. It's really spooky. So that part is the stuff that I knew. What I didn't know is that the reason the M1 Abrams tank moves at 45 miles an hour is because they've got a speed governor in it. And they have that installed so that, one, the tankers don't burn out their engines, and two, they don't outrun their other assets like mounted infantry. You know, because the last thing you want is for tanks to be out there completely unsupported where people with javelins can, pick them off. You know, tanks really need to be part of a combined arms approach. But if speed is of an essence, the mechanics can remove that governor and the M1 Abrams tank can move at 70 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
Dear God.
I mean, I knew many of those facts, especially you said that the tank runs on jet fuel, and you are 100% correct on that. That is the preferred fuel, but you could run it on damn near anything. I think you could run it on gasoline. You could definitely run it on like ethanol. You could run it on diesel. Like literally, if it burns, you can run it.
I just want to point out, the M1 Abrams tank weighs 55 tons. A 55-ton tracked vehicle can go 70 miles an hour. I'm terrified in the best way possible. You know, things that heavy, especially on track, shouldn't go that fast.
And this is why you need to vote for Aaron, so she can co-drive tanks.
Oh, I'm nearly positive they won't have an Abrams. They might have like a Sherman or something.
They definitely have a Sherman. I've seen that. I haven't even watched. There's one of the guys that works there has a YouTube channel, which I'm not that super into armor. So I haven't really got. I've watched a few of his videos. He's great and he's interesting. It's just not my forte. But let me tell you, if I was there, it'd be my forte because tanks are cool. They're really cool. But let's get a whole bunch of stuff to talk about, I don't want to talk about my day. let's just say it was uphill both ways in the snow. That last part was quite. The first part was figurative. The last part was quite literally. We've gotten our first big snowstorm of the year, and it was just petering out after dinner. So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna get out there and shovel so that I can get this done before I can sit down and read up on the stories, so I'll be moderately familiar with them. Apologies if I am not as familiar as normal, because it's been a busy damn day. So I've been pushing snow around, and I don't want to talk about it.
Okay. Well, the first thing that I want to talk about is that Blazing Sword is over the target, because we are receiving flak. On Friday, I made an announcement across all of social media, hopefully you've seen it by now, where I noted that we, in association with the National African American Gun Association, the Asian Pacific American Gun Owners of America, and the DC Project, hereafter referred to as the Historically Discriminated Coalition, filed an amicus brief against Oregon Measure 114. And it was very well received. Well, unless you count the cancerous comments on AmmoLand, but, you know, it's AmmoLand. What are you going to do? And so that was Friday. On Saturday, I'm sitting down to game with some of my friends, and I started getting emails from our hosting company saying, essentially, here's that login token you asked for. And I hadn't asked for it. And so I called up... He refers to himself as the social media mammal. So that's what I'm going to refer to him as, although sometimes he's three raccoons in a trench coat. And I got on Facebook Messenger and I said, I think we're being hacked. Because, you know, explain. And it's like, I'm on it, chief. Well, the good news is we weren't being hacked. The bad news is we had been affected by malware. And it unfortunately shut the site down, sometime Saturday night, because that's the way this particular hosting company goes. They don't want other people to be infected by the malware, so as soon as they detect it, they shut everything down. And so Social Media Mammal got on it, and we paid extra to have things cleaned and expedited, and we're told that things would be up by sometime on Sunday. Needless to say, things were not up by Sunday, and it was, I want to say like 2 or 3 in the afternoon today that we finally got things back online. And so nothing was lost because we had things backed up. I don't understand computer wizardry. Media Mammal does, and he's on it. And so everything is good now. We don't yet know where it's from. We may never know who did it, but he was able to determine it was a directed denial of service attack. And so I don't know if this was the result of us filing the AC brief. I don't know if this was because... So actually, on Monday was the beginning of SHOT Show, and Students Demand Action, which is the kid version of Moms Demand Action, also a wholly owned subsidiary of Bloomberg Incorporated, started filing all sorts of things, and we demand this. And I posted I talked some smack about Bloomberg, and it was completely honest and substantiated, but I talked some smack about Bloomberg. And so maybe he got butt hurt, because it's not like he has a track record of having a fragile ego or anything.
Documented.
So, you know, I don't know really who we annoyed, but the fact that someone decided we deserved a DDoS tells me that they see us as a threat, and you know they want to take us out, and so that is weirdly affirming.
And for those who listen to the Weird Audio Fisks, know I like a good scrap. Well, this is awesome. I mean, it's also, again, this is why Aaron is one is in the important Second Amendment voices category for the Gundy Awards. Vote for Aaron because she does stuff like this. Any good smack you talked about, Bloomberg?
Okay, so Students Demand Action tweeted, "The gun industry is celebrating another year of profits at SHOT Show 2023 in Vegas while we pay the price with our lives. Not on our watch. We demand that gun makers step up and take action to save lives. Read our full list of demands and add your name." And there's a video attached, which I didn't watch, and it's just, "Oh, so you're impotently demanding things. Okay, that's cute." And my response was, "Students Demand Action is a subsidiary of Everytown, which is wholly owned, funded, and controlled by Michael Bloomberg, who hides behind well-armed security guards carrying, quote, gun industry products. You're a mouthpiece for a hypocrite, Students Demand."
Well played. That's true. Michael Bloomberg has got a massive security force made up almost exclusively of former NYPD officers. And he brings them everywhere he goes, including to his house in Bermuda. And he needs special exemptions from the Bermuda government because regular people can't just bring their security team onto the island.
So, I mean, obviously they didn't reply to that.
No.
And I didn't really expect them to. They started doing a whole lot more things, and eventually I just got annoyed of their whining and I muted them. But, you know, I got some retweets. I got some likes. I'm happy.
Good enough. And then, of course, you've got this amicus brief against this horrible friggin' bill in Oregon.
Yep. So I irritated somebody, and they tried to take us down, and they didn't.
Well, so speaking of, as they say, the gun company is they demand gun laws to keep them safe. Let's talk about the land of gun laws. And I don't want to be smug about this, but...
Well, the thing is, you need to clarify, because that could be New York, that could be New Jersey, that could be Hawaii, that could be California.
It happens to be California, the Los Angeles County, where they have had yet another mass killing in this area with massive gun control laws, and specifically in the county that is hyper, hyper, hyper focused on gun control. And it's still fairly early on. Was this this morning? I forgot what.
No,
was this yesterday?
It was sometime over the weekend, because I saw a California friend of mine marking himself safe in the Monterey shooting. I don't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday, to be honest.
But either way, this was an elderly gentleman. Who happens
72 years old.
Yep, and happens to be of Asian descent. So gone is the white and young stereotype, mm-hmm. that is frequently floated around. Is male. There's okay. I don't think there's
Saturday night is when it happened.
Okay,
10:22 p.m.
Yep, but they this person was went to two separate dance studios and was. I think they did most of their shooting at the first one, and then when they got to the second one, somebody intervened and actually fought with him and got his gun away, and he fled and then took his own life.
Yeah, so this guy, and people are still trying to figure out the motives. Mm-hmm. So the shooter, who we don't name, interestingly enough, had a criminal record because he was convicted of unlawful possession of a firearm in 1990. So, you know, it's not like he was a normal law-abiding gun owner and then snapped. No, he's been a piece of crap for 30-some years now. And interestingly enough, I believe the dance studio that he shot up was where he met his wife in the 80s, something like that. So I don't remember all the details, but, and of course, everything is conjecture, but it may be just he got really mad. Maybe it was an anniversary and he just decided to shoot up the place where he met his wife because they got divorced like about a year later or something. He had, and this would be an interesting segue for one of your interviews, but we have to wait for that, because I'm pretty sure that a MAC-10 is not on the approved roster for California handguns or any sort of weapon.
It may not be. I know for a fact that we can't get any of the various MAC clones here in Massachusetts under our handgun safety roster.
Yeah. So he used a MAC-10, not full auto, semi-auto, but with an extended magazine. So we're currently at 3 felonies, and then he went to the studio and shot a bunch of people, and then drove to another studio, and he was getting ready to shoot it, and someone who worked there basically was in the foyer, the vestibule, saw the guy, and I don't know if he was like loading the gun or whatever, and he saw what was going on, and he, well, I don't want to say if I, he tackled the guy, but the point being was he figured, well, I'm going to die anyway. I might as well try and save some people, and wrestled the guy for the gun and managed to get it out of his hand. And so this is an interesting twist where the good guy with the gun stopped a bad guy with a gun, but it was the bad guy's gun that he stopped him with. But still, a good guy stopped the problem by making the bad guy's gun the good guy's gun. And then called the police because the shooter then immediately ran away and he fled. And the police, I don't know if they knew it was his van when they pulled him over or if they just noticed something weird. I think that something like stolen plates or whatever. But the point being, when he was pulled over, he parked the car and then shot himself in the head. And then he was later identified as being the perpetrator of both the Monterey Park shooting and the Alhambra. Well, it wasn't a shooting, fortunately.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, again, our heart goes out to the victims and heart goes out to the community. And I actually was just listening to while I was shoveling Cam and Company interviewing Cam Edwards and interviewing Chris Chang talking about this. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, but just my heart goes out to the community and it's, and, especially, you know, my gratitude goes out to the person who did the right thing, which was jump in and intervene. Again, when you are in a situation like this, you've got to consider yourself. You're already in the bubble. It's already the combat zone. There's a chance that you are going to die. Mm-hmm. And so you might as well just be as brave as you can be because, mm-hmm. and fight back as hard as you can because, even in the instance where, I mean, we had, it was in Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Wasn't that the one where the coach actually charged the shooter?
I believe so.
Yes, I believe so. And I this is only just coming to me right now, so unfortunately, I've forgotten the coach's name. Yeah, he charged at the shooter, and he was ended up being killed and did not stop. Obviously, the shooter got away, but the fact that he was struggling and tied him up definitely allowed other people to get away. So his life mm-hmm. saved many others, even in this quote unquote failed attempt to stop the shooter. And so
I may mispronounce the guy's name because it's spelled F-E-I-S, but I don't know if it's Feiss or Feiss or whatever, but football coach Aaron Feiss is who you're thinking of.
Thank you so much for looking that up.
And he was shot several times while protecting students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Yeah, so that was a quote-unquote unsuccessful. He was not able to disarm mm-hmm. the shooter. He was not able to stop the attack and all mm-hmm. that. And I say that quote-unquote because he was a hero and he absolutely did some amazing mm-hmm. good in giving those people some time to get away. So, mm-hmm. so that's, it is definitely something to keep in the back of your mind in the event that you are stuck in this. And so, you know, just getting out there is that fight back, Hopefully you got a gun so that you don't have to get into the really, really risky situation of closing the distance, engaging and physically wrestling with the killer. And instead you could do something like Eli Dick at a very, very relaxed range, core the person's skull out. Mm-hmm. Or Jack Wilson. Oh, what a good shot for Jack Wilson. But yeah, so the man who fought him, did they name the guy who did this?
Yes, and I was waiting to segue into that. Yes, his name is Brandon Tsay, T-S-A-Y, I may be mispronouncing that, and says here he is 26 years old, he is a computer coder, and his family owned that ballroom. So he may not have been an employee, but, you know, it was a family business, so he was helping out, or just happened to be there. And so, yeah, it says he encountered the gunman alone in the lobby, grabbed the gun, you know, wrestled it away from him, fended him off, and then, you know, the guy ran off, and then Brandon called the police. So, yeah, Brandon Tsay, you were definitely a hero. Good job.
Awesome. I mean, great, great job. And yeah, that's awesome to hear. And we don't name the killer's names, but absolutely, if you fight and stop with the killer, we are going to name your name because you are a hero and you deserve our praise.
Absolutely.
So, we were talking about assault weapons bans and other gun laws. Well, we mentioned last week. I mean, this is our third week in the row. First one is hey, contact your people, and then they rushed to it and passed that assault weapons ban. Like in the time it took me to edit the podcast, it was. It really surprised me, but now come the next podcast.
Well, hang on. They didn't just pass it because they pulled some jiggery pokery. This was originally going to be a bill about theme park safety. And then at the last minute, they added gun control bills in there. And you were telling me how this may be against parliamentary procedure.
Yes, I just overheard that. I'm trying to remember if it was in a podcast or if I read it somewhere, but I overheard that there is a lawsuit that is en route that is actually challenging this on not this case here that we're about to talk about was challenging it on constitutional grounds, which is really the rock solid way because it pretty much just says and stay out. You know, not only does it repeal the law, but it also affirms the Second Amendment in the state as well. But there is talk that there was parliamentary violations as well. So therefore the law was not lawfully passed. And so, yeah, if this doesn't work out, or this is a weird story because it says the judge, it's only being enacted, the only 866 plaintiffs. Four licensed firearms dealers and the rest are individuals will be exempted from this assault weapons ban. But it sounds like everybody else is still subject to enforcement. I've never heard of such a thing.
I've never heard of such a thing either. And, well, up until this point, I wouldn't have thought it was possible. It would have been my understanding that if the judge puts a stop to it, you know, the law stopped and it stopped for everyone. But not just for the plaintiffs and no one else. What the heck?
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm baffled. So I don't really understand how that's going. Maybe we will hear some information from some of our listeners on how exactly this works out and how this will affect, you know, the millions of other people that live in that state.
It's Chicagoland, Jack.
Yeah, that's true. So it's good to hear that that's getting pushed back. I mean, that seems to be kind of the story of how everything's going through. Is the anti-gunners pass a law, we sue them, and the judge says, yeah, no, thank you. So hopefully that will keep going in a trend. It'd be great if they just gave up.
It would be great. I'll just be over here holding my breath and turning blue.
Yeah, please don't do that. Speaking of garbage laws that are pending lawsuits, we also talked last week about the arm brace pistols being ruled NFA items by complete BS. I stumbled across a bunch of people are quoting this. I've got a link to Reddit that has a screen capture of it with highlighter on it, that states, the criminal violation under 18 USC code 922R is for the assembly of the semi-automatic rifle. Therefore, modification of this kind of firearm through removal of the relevant parts would not cure the 922R, violation. ATF assumes this group may use another scenario, such as destroying the firearm or turning it into the ATF. What it's essentially saying is, if you have a foreign-made gun that has had a pistol brace attached to it, going on the extra stupid nature of our gun laws, in that guns remember, namely, if you were to take the auto sear out of a machine gun, it will remember it's a machine gun.
Homeopathy.
Yeah, we talked about homeopathy. I wasn't ready
or
for
homeopathy,
that
or however the hell you pronounce it. I mean, I literally talked about it last week. You know, hey, water has memory, and so do guns. Apparently, that's what the ATF believes.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the Serbu super shorty in the past, where essentially Mark Serbu, he doesn't make him anymore, but Mark Serbu would buy Virgin receivers from either Remington or Mossberg, depending on which version he was making, and then build this little teeny tiny shotgun that has no stock. And the statement for that is, because he is not making it with a shoulder stock, and it is smaller, I think smaller than 26 inches, I think is necessary for this build, and it's on a Virgin receiver, so it's never been a full-size shotgun. That allows it to be registered as an any other weapon and only subject to a $5 tax, instead of the $200 tax of being a short-barreled shotgun, if you were to build the exact same gun from a pre-existing shotgun, because the shotgun remembers. Yeah, it's dumb. So yeah, so according to this, they are saying, even though I also listening while I was shoveling, I was listening to Stephen Gutowski talking about his time at SHOT Show in the Reload podcast, and he was saying Deedlebotch was or Deedle Beach or Deedle Snoot,
Beetlejuice,
exactly, was the ATF director was in front of what appeared at SHOT Show and talked to the audience, and he actually got asked a question about braced pistols. And according to Stephen Gutowski, he said that you could just take the pistol brace off of the gun. So I don't know.
So the ATF director contradicted ATF policy?
Or maybe he wrote new policy. It's not like any of this makes sense. These are literal firearms that the ATF said it was totally okay to sell, and then they said they weren't okay to use, and then now they're saying that they're NFA items. I don't know. It's crap. But according to this, what they're trying to say is, if you bought a gun, specifically a gun that was shipped from the factory with a pistol brace installed, and the gun itself was not made within the United States, it would need to comply with essentially the 922R parts. And there, it may have actually been a violation from the get-go, because the gun shop technically shouldn't have sold a non-922R gun.
Because reasons.
Yeah. And so... yeah, this is essentially saying, yeah, if you've got like a stocked or an arm brace equipped Draco pistol, or Oddball, who's very, very thankful he did not put an arm brace on his MP5 clone, which I think is Turkish, that might mean that it's an SBR forever, no matter how you reconfigure it, and also a non-922R compliant SBR. So just another thing to be aware of in these dark, dark days of the government declaring that your pistol braces are NFA items.
On a related note, this is something that hadn't occurred to me, but someone pointed it out, and it makes perfect sense. And the way it works is, all right, so let's say that you want to be compliant, and you want to keep your pistol brace, and so you decide to register it with the ATF during their amnesty period. Well, the ATF is not known for being speedy, and I believe this amnesty period only is for, well, I see the number 88 days in front of me. I don't know if that's specifically how long it is, but considering that it takes a year or more for the ATF to process suppressor forms, essentially what you're doing is when you tell the ATF, hey, I'd like to register this, they don't get to it before the amnesty runs out. You've just admitted to constructive possession of a federal prohibited item, and they know where you are. And they can come confiscate the item, or they can arrest you, or both, and your dog will get shot.
Especially when you note that part of the rule for this exemption from the $200 tax stamp is that you photograph the firearm so they can confirm that it is in this braced configuration, and therefore eligible for the refunded amnesty, the waived fee.
Yeah. So it's not just constructive possession, it's literal construction.
Yes. And again, this is a bad order of operations to begin with. If I was going to take my FAL and I wanted to make it into a short-barreled rifle, I would first do the Form 1 and submit it. And then when I got my tax stamp back, then I could either take it to a gunsmith or cut it down myself, not the other way around. And that's the tough situation that we're in as far as that goes. So yeah. And furthermore, I've talked that, like, if they take too long to process your application, and note that there might be a whole lot of people who are going to start submitting guns for registration because they want to keep it in the current configuration. And it might be enticing to waive the $200 fee. The system's going to get flooded, and then a whole bunch of things are going to get default denied because the background checks are not going to go through. And then, now what? You're stuck with an illegal SBR, and now you get a denial in your hand. It seems pretty treacherous.
So, under no circumstances am I encouraging you to break the law. That would be wrong. What I am encouraging you to do is to take the course of action which protects yourself and your family and your pets.
I think that's sound advice. So, what's not sound advice is to take gun safety tips from Alec Baldwin. It's a rough segue. I did the best I could. But breaking news is that Alec Baldwin is being charged with involuntary manslaughter, I believe.
Remember, you can't spell manslaughter without laughter.
That's true.
Yes, he's being charged with two counts of involuntary manslaughter.
So is Hannah Gutierrez Reed, as well as the assistant director, who was the man who allegedly actually handed the firearm to Mr. Baldwin and said that it was a quote unquote cold gun.
Now, what's interesting is that according to this article, the assistant director signed a plea agreement for the charge of negligent use of a deadly weapon and got a suspended sentence in exchange for testifying against Baldwin and Gutierrez Reed.
Mm-hmm.
So at least one person has flipped.
Yep.
And I don't want to make it sound like I am dancing in blood. I am certainly not happy that one woman was killed and a man was wounded. I would prefer that this never happened. But it did happen, and I've got to say, it happened to a very deserving individual. Because, I mean, this was like October of 2021 at this point. But remember, Baldwin immediately launched into how it wasn't his fault, and he did nothing wrong, and he didn't pull the trigger. and all these sorts of things. And, you know, it was a case of methinks the lady doth protest too much. And you had all sorts of people going, no, he's full of crap, because we've got an exact copy of that type of revolver, and here's how it could have happened. And a bunch of other things. And it was just, the more he denied, the more it seemed like he was guilty. He knew he was guilty, and he was trying to throw other people under the bus in order to save his ass. And Alec Baldwin is not a nice guy. If you watch any, like, my mom really loves Entertainment Tonight, and I remember however many years ago when he got drunk and called his daughter a little pig. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a nice person. I believe he's also being sued for slandering a dead Marine. I don't know the details of that. He's not a good person, really. I mean, if you watch Team America, it's pretty spot on. And so while I would prefer this never happened, you know, I can't think of a more deserving person to have this happen to. And it really, really does seem like he's going to be convicted, because it's not just the facts, but also the way that he has done this. And he has stated that he will not be convicted. And that's baiting the bear, folks.
And the fact that he is such a huge proponent for gun control. I mean, he is stood up for every little bit of gun control out there that he's got there. He's a resident of New York City and has no issues with the gun control laws there. And the fact that he could handle a firearm so negligently to cause this is another reason to say that we absolutely need firearm safety to be taught in schools. Because maybe you'll never own a gun in your life, maybe you'll never go shooting, but hey, you might be on a movie set where guns are being handled, and might be in your best interest to say, hey, if this gun's being waved around in here and I'm holding a boom mic, maybe I could see that all the chambers are empty, or inspect all the rounds in the gun to make sure that they are dummies and or blanks.
There's a jafe going around, and I don't know which movie it was, but it was a Will Smith movie, and it was the briefing before they started filming, and the guns were on the table, and somebody, I can't see who, because everything other than his hand is out of frame, and he picks up a gun, and he proceeds to flag people with it, and Will Smith very smoothly just, you know, I don't remember exactly the order of operations, but reaches up, pushes the gun so that it's not flagging people, pulls it out of the guy's hand, you know, makes sure that the chamber is safe, sets it down, and gives the guy a glare. And then at the last part where the sound comes on, it's thank you, Will. I'm going to see if I can dig it up, because it's really good. And it's like, okay, this is clearly a man who pays attention, who knows how guns work, who understands, respects, and performs firearm safety.
Yeah. There's also a very, very famous instance on the set of Blue Bloods when someone was mishandling a firearm on set, and Tom Selleck just absolutely erupted into a rage that someone would be handling a firearm so negligently. And some people are like, oh, but it was on a TV set, and it was all that. Well, that's how accidents like this happen, is the fact that you just don't do this. The idea of pointing a firearm at another human being and pulling the trigger just as a display should make somebody's blood run cold. And I remember showing my dad after that. My dad was asking some questions about it, so I went downstairs and got some revolvers and brought them up and was showing him exactly, you know, how a revolver works and what might have happened with the gun. And every time I was going to pull the trigger to show him, I was popping open the cylinder and inspecting it, and I also showed my father, look, this is the cylinder, here are the chambers, the cartridges go in here. If you look in here and you can't see any cartridges, that means the gun's unloaded. And just just to show and pointing them in a safe direction and pulling the trigger, I still wanted a click instead of a bang. And that led me to take extra steps. And so I hope that a lot of good. Unfortunately, every time we have lost an actor on a movie set due to a firearms mistake, they have made some really, really good changes to things so that it makes this harder and harder to happen. All right. Going back to California. California now has a new handgun on their very restrictive handgun roster, and it's a modern practical one, the SIG P320. When my friend Clark told me about this, I was baffled, and I asked him how on earth this happened, and he was started explaining to me. I said, you know what, better yet, explain it to us, the Assorted Calibers podcast. Well, I'm pleased to welcome to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Clark. And Clark, you are an employee at a gun store in California. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. The reason why I'm having you on is because you sent me the information on the California legal P320 by Sig Sauer, and we don't need to dive into too deep onto the technicals of it, what do you know about this? Because obviously I don't think your store's got these units yet, have they?
No, we're expecting them in March.
Okay, excellent. So what is your understanding of how this California compliant P320 works?
Yeah, so basically in order to comply with the California roster, which is basically a list of handguns that civilians are allowed to buy in California. It's a list of guns that they've deemed to be safe. And in order to comply with that, but also get onto the list, they've made it a single shot firearm that's not able to take a magazine.
Yeah. So there's no magazine well on the gun. And there's just a little, essentially a raceway where the feed lips for the magazine would be. So you just chamber around, shoot it, and then you need to lock the slide back manually and insert a fresh round.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason that they couldn't get on the list with the standard P320 is because California has a micro stamping requirement to get added to the roster now. And they require two places on the bullet every time you fire to be micro stamped with the serial number, which is a technology that doesn't exist.
Yep, doesn't exist, doesn't work. No one does it. And so literally it is to get a gun on the roster that may work. You either have to have been in before the micro stamping law or be single shot.
Yep. The single shot is how they're getting around that. There's a bunch of other requirements that California has added to the list. And so with the P320, the benefit is because the FCU is the actual firearm, you're able to just take off that grip, swap on a new one, and you've got now a normal firearm.
Yeah, I am somewhat familiar with this. One of my everyday carries is a SIG 365. And in Massachusetts, our specific firearms roster, in Massachusetts, California, Maryland, is there another one? Do you know off the top of your head?
I think Oregon's working on one, but not at the moment.
But not at the moment, yeah. But so very, very few states have this handgun safety roster where a firearm must be, and it's only been handguns, I believe, must be approved for sale within the state before a dealer can sell them. And so in the state of Massachusetts, one of the regulations is it needs to have a greater than 10-pound pull weight on the trigger pull, unless the gun has a manual safety. So 1911s are legal to be sold in Massachusetts if they're approved per the testing here. But so Sig Sauer, instead of developing a heavier trigger specifically for Massachusetts, Smith & Wesson did it for the M&Ps. They actually have a Massachusetts compliant trigger pack that they use. They just simply threw the thumb safety on the 365. And then I turned around and bought a Wilson Combat Grip module that didn't have the cut for the safety, and then pulled out my fire control group, pulled off the safety, dropped the fire control group into the new grip module, then reinstalled my slide, and away I went. And that is, I'm free and clear talking about that. That is 100% legal. And it's your understanding that that's also 100% legal in California?
Yeah. So there's been multiple lawyers who have come out and said that it is in fact legal for you to switch that to a semi-auto pistol once you own it. However, the DOJ did send out a disclaimer that's on their website saying that it, quote, may be illegal to convert it. Mm-hmm. Multiple lawyers have come out saying there's no law that supports that. That's the DOJ just trying to scare everybody. And it's been a few years now that single-shot pistols have been on the roster and that people have been converting them with no known arrests for them.
Excellent. Well, and so now one other thing we got talking about when you were telling me about this is that, so in Massachusetts, we have private sales, if I may throw the scare quotes font on my voice for that, in that I am allowed to sell with friends and people that I meet firearms. And I've done this on multiple occasions. You know, you can do it in a parking lot. You can do it at a gun club. You could do it at somebody's house. And it is face-to-face transfer. You're limited to four of them per year in the state of Massachusetts. And here's the big and, there is a form called the FA-10 form, which is now online, and you need to log into onto a Massachusetts website and enter in your license number, the license number of the person who sells it to you, and then the make, model, and serial number of the firearm and all the vital statistics of the gun that's being transferred. And then that gun is essentially entered into the Massachusetts Firearms Registry. So it's a private sale, though if the government is not completely in bed with it, it's against the law. And so you live in California, and we were talking about off-roster guns because there are some trades with off-roster guns. So first up, how would somebody get an off-roster gun? How might a gun get into circulation in California off the roster?
The typical way that an off-roster gun comes into sale is either from someone moving into California with that firearm, in which case they then register it and are free to, you know, sell it, carry it, do the same thing as if it was an on-roster firearm.
One of my off-roster firearms is exactly that. Somebody moved in from the state of Texas and happened to bring some guns that I was particularly interested in.
Yeah, and then the other way, which is actually more common, is you can buy it from a law enforcement officer. And so the problem with that is we will have law enforcement officers come in. They are exempt from the one handgun per 30-day limit, and they are exempt from the 10-day waiting period as well. So we will have officers come in, they will buy 15 of the same gun, and then they will go around and resell them for 2 to 3 times the retail price.
Crazy. We don't have the exemption. We do have officers that do absolutely that. I know that there was one officer near me who just would buy 4 Kel-Tec P380s every year, and then sell them at double the price that he paid for them, and that was just a little side hustle he had. But I believe he can only sell 4 a year, but that I'm not sure on.
Yeah, so here it's limited to 4 transactions a year. Mm-hmm. So we will have each officer come in. They will do on one transaction. They will sell 3 or 4 off-roster firearms. And then the other way that they get around that is there's another way of transferring guns called an intrafamilial transfer. So they'll transfer them to their spouse or to their family members, who then are also limited to that 4 transaction number. And so they make a large amount of money, and we will see the same officers come in month after month selling the exact same guns, you know, because they no longer want them, to civilians who otherwise couldn't buy them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, God bless them for doing that, and they could charge whatever they want. In my opinion, the only complaint I have is that you have the law on the books in the first place. So how does it work? So in Massachusetts, this is the big one I really wanted to talk to you about, and I don't fully understand. In Massachusetts, I have absolutely been in a gun shop with a friend, JG from Shooting Illustrated, who's been on the Assorted Calibers podcast in previous episodes. When he left the state, he went and liquidated all of the guns that were valuable in the state of Massachusetts because they were off roster, because they were rare, because they were grandfathered, and he knew that he could either didn't need them anymore or could buy a suitable replacement for them. And so he liquidated everything to people within the state for the exact reasons that we're explaining here. It's hard to get certain guns in the state. And so certain guns that go through, when I leave this state, there'll be a bunch of my guns that I will be selling, even though I love them to death. But I know that if I want to, I can get them out of state very, very easily. And they're very difficult for other people to get. But one of the guns that we were transferring, it's a North American Arms mini revolver. The dealer was like, I can't verify that this gun is grandfathered in and it's not on the roster. So he just simply refused the transfer. He wouldn't transfer it because for him to take it in and put it on his books and then transfer it to me would have been a violation of our roster. How does that work in California?
Yeah, so we don't verify. California doesn't even have a mechanism for us to verify how somebody got a firearm, whether they moved here with it, they bought it from a law enforcement officer, whether they went to another state, picked it up in a parking lot and brought it over. We have no way of checking. And in California, even private party transactions still have to go through a dealer where they'll enter the dealer's logbook, they'll go through the state system and wait the 10 days. And so there, we do occasionally have people that will come in who are new residents who haven't registered or who picked them up in other states. And we will still, transfer those firearms because California doesn't have a way for us to verify how those firearms, entered the state. And the other thing is California doesn't care. They require us to do PPTs.
Yep.
We're not allowed to say no to someone for a PPT.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And so essentially, two people come in, a gun gets dropped off, a background check is performed, and then one person comes back 10 days later and picks up the gun?
Yeah, that's how it works.
I mean, I'm always amused by how much pain in the butt anti-gun states put in, and then the few loopholes that they put in where it's one of those like, oh yeah, but you can get around this if you do this and that, and we don't care.
Yeah. Everything in California, if you have enough time or you have enough money, you're able to bypass any of California's gun laws.
Well, that's crazy. Well, I mean, thank you so much for fighting the good fight in California. I mean, the gun culture is alive and well in the anti-gun states, as you and I can both say. And as much of a pain in the butt it is wonderful to have support for people that like the Second Amendment and like shooting sports, even if you're in an anti-gun state. And thank you so much for coming on the Assorted Calibers podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I just want to make sure I understand properly. The CA SIG P320 is a single shot. There's no capacity for a magazine. You've got to lock the slide back, drop the round essentially into the chamber, rechamber the gun. It fires once, and it doesn't even have like a bolt hold open. You've got to then lock it back and load it.
Correct. It'll eject the spent casing, and then the action will slam close on an empty chamber.
Uh-huh. But the interesting thing about the SIG P320 is that the serialized part, the legal part that is the gun, is not the receiver. It's the fire control group. So the loophole here, I mean, you know, what they call a loophole is us adhering to the laws, but I'm sure once California figures this out, they're going to crap a little red schoolhouse and move to ban this. But the workaround here is that you buy the California compliant gun, you take out the part that is the gun, you then legally buy the non-gun parts of the bottom that will accept a magazine and the slide, which doesn't lock back after. Well, no, whatever.
The slide should be fine. It's simply you pop out the fire control. You'd have to take off the slide to do this, but you pop off the fire control group and then simply replace the grip module.
Okay.
And buy some magazine. Have any.
Right. I mean, I understand how it works. I understand that it's currently legal. I don't know how long it's going to take for the Californians to figure this out, but I think the moment they do, they are going to crap themselves. And go, no, this isn't what we wanted. And they will try and pass a law to outlaw it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. but I know that they're going to try. Especially, because this is clearly not what they wanted.
Especially the sheer number of chassis-based pistols that are out there right now. It is, I mean, SIG's got at least two. You know, the Steyr, the Steyr M9 is an M40 is a chassis gun. Not many people know about that, but there's a huge number of guns out there that have migrated over to this chassis system where you can swap out the various parts around it and reconfigure it. Which in it itself, I believe the SIG P250, which was the first SIG chassis gun, I believe that was actually designed to defeat German gun laws. SIG Sauer obviously being a German company, and Germany being, and I forget the actual law, but they have an arsenal law where essentially you can only own X number of guns. And when you get up to that threshold to buy a new gun, it means you have to sell another gun. And so the 250 and now the 320 absolutely capitalize on that, because you want a subcompact 380. You just set it up that way. You want a full size 45. You set it up that way. You want a full size 9. No problem. You set it up that way. So it's a very, very useful gun for Californians to own, because there's any number of configurations you can do. And according to Clark, that's perfectly legal. It's certainly legal here in Massachusetts as well. And in theory, I could convert my SIG 365 over to all sorts of potential configurations. If I so wanted to, so long as I don't buy evil magazines that hold more than 10.
So why haven't you done so?
I have. Mine's a mass compliant gun, and it had a thumb safety on it that I wasn't using, and so I bought a Wilson Combat Grip module and took the thumb safety off.
Oh, good.
And I have it just done to the bigger sizes, number one, because it's my pocket carry gun and I want it small. And two, I don't want to make it any bigger, because then it will have to take limited magazines. And so why stick a magazine in a grip built for 15 or 17 rounds and it only holds 10? Ugh. Makes me mad. It's another reason why weird. I love 1911s and revolvers, because they're legal in Massachusetts, and I don't have to neuter them.
So weird. Do you know what makes me mad?
What makes you mad, Aaron?
Well, many things, but in this particular case, our friend Logan Medish has some very troubling information about the NRA Firearms Museum.
That's why I sat down and talked to Logan about this. I am so pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Logan Medish. Logan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And of course, you are with High Caliber History. If you're not subscribed to the YouTube channel, you should absolutely do that. And do you still do the podcast? You don't do the podcast anymore, do you?
As time permits. I've gotten pretty busy with other things. And but if you guys haven't listened to it, there's 25 episodes of backlog for you to go work your way through. So
honestly speaking, I've listened to every single one of them, and they are really good. They are really, really good. So you absolutely into that. But you of course are a professional museum curator, and you have worked at the NRA Museum. That's correct.
That is correct.
And the NRA Museum, it's in the news.
It is in the news, and for all the wrong reasons.
why don't you lay out what this news story is all about? Because nobody wants to hear me summarize it.
So the TLDR version is all the stops have been pulled out, and Wayne LaPierre now has unilateral control as to whether or not the museum collection can be sold to pay their legal bills or suit bills or electric bills or whatever, which is not how a museum is supposed to work. So that's the TLDR version of it. The full version is that NRA just had their winter board meeting in Dallas, Texas, which, sidebar, it has always boggled my mind why they pay to have their board meetings, you know, in other states when they've got an entire office building in the DC area that is perfectly equipped to have their meetings in with plenty of hotels around, but whatever. So anyway, so they had their meetings in Dallas, and all of the different committees meet. And they go through and they do whatever it is they do to keep themselves doing Wayne's bidding. And one of the committees that met was, of course, the Finance Committee. And they proposed and made a motion to repeal and replace an older motion that had been in place since 1989. And the best way for me to explain it is to just read it to you guys. And so the motion from 1989 reads, quote, moved that all firearms received through bequests, donations, and other means be reviewed by the NRA Gun Collectors Committee to determine items suitable for museum accession or deaccession. Furthermore, that after such review, all firearms deemed in excess or suitable for deaccession may be sold or disposed of after consultation with the Finance Committee in a manner best serving the interests of the National Rifle Association, with such funds received from the disposition to be earmarked for museum purposes. So basically what that says is that in 1989, they all got together and agreed that guns that are offered for donation to the museum should be looked at by a group of trusted collectors on the Gun Collector Committee. And then it's decided, yes, you know, this is what we recommend you keep. And no, you know, this is surplus stuff. Sell it off. And then the proceeds go back into the museum's budget. Perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with that. Museums deaccession things from time to time. This is not a unique circumstance. And logically, you know, money from deaccessioned items goes back into a museum collection. Well, that first and foremost, that's not how things actually ended up working when I was at the NRA Museum. The majority of the folks on the Gun Collector Committee are nice people. You know, they're very knowledgeable gun collectors, but they know very little about museums. They were instrumental in helping get things rolling back in 1998 to get the main National Firearms Museum established in Fairfax, Virginia. But beyond that, you know, they're not really museum people. And so in the almost 5 years that I was there, I don't know that I am aware of a single donation or potential donation that actually went through that committee in any kind of official capacity. By sheer happenstance, the chairman of that committee is also on the board of directors and is disgustingly tied up in all sorts of other things. And things were done that are absolutely shady and quite possibly illegal. That was the only involvement of the Gun Collector Committee, was by sheer happenstance that he happened to be on that committee. But so even though the gun collectors didn't do a whole lot in terms of helping to safeguard the museum collection, the fact of the matter is that it's that safeguard did still technically exist. That was in the bylaws and had been in the bylaws since 1989. But that changed. The Finance Committee put forth a new resolution, and let me read that to you so that you can hear the difference in this. Quote, now, therefore, be it resolved that the May 1989 resolution is hereby rescinded, and be it further resolved that the Executive Vice President, sidebar, that's Wayne LaPierre, is hereby directed to continue or establish such procedures governing the gift of firearms as may best protect the assets of the National Rifle Association and maximize the value of firearms donated to the National Rifle Association and its affiliates, taking into account both the value of such gifts to NRA museums and the value to the National Rifle Association and its affiliates of the disposition or use of any such firearms. You notice some things that are missing from that. There's no mention of oversight by the Finance Committee, which is the committee that put forth this new change. There's no mention of oversight by museum staff. There's no mention of oversight by the Gun Collectors Committee. Instead, all that it mentions is that it's at the direction of the executive vice president. The board has essentially ceded all responsibility for what gets done with the museum guns. So they said to maximize the value of firearms donated to the National Rifle Association. It doesn't say anything about, this is just moving forward. It doesn't say anything about whether it's retroactive or not. It just says directed to continue or establish procedures governing the gift of firearms as may best protect the assets of the NRA. And I think that's key too, these donations to help protect the assets of the NRA. Well, at this point, the NRA doesn't have a whole lot of assets. They are absolutely hemorrhaging money, as most of your listeners know. And so to me, the way I understand this is that Wayne LaPierre now has the only say in what happens to the guns in that collection, meaning that, if he deemed tomorrow that they all need to be sold off, that is entirely within his power and his power alone to do that. And it's interesting to me, when you look at some numbers in terms of money with the collection and legal bills. So the most recent IRS Form 990 for the NRA Foundation, which is what the NRA Museum falls under, is from 2019, and it lists under the assets the museum collection with a value of $31.7 million. So it's not chump change. There's some amazing stuff in there. But the 2022 budget, the legal budget for their general counsel division, had a budget of $31 million. So the 2022 budget for legal bills is the exact same amount as what the value of the museum collection is. And then the real kicker is that reports through November of 2022, so they still had a month to go, they spent $48.4 million in legal fees. So they outspent their budget by $17 million. So the short version of that is they could sell every single piece of the museum and still not cover their legal fees for 1 year.
I mean, that's, my blood is running cold at this, because especially given all of the shenanigans that have been going on in the NRA over the, I mean, really it's been going on for decades, but a lot of it's come to light in the last few years.
Yeah.
Like, you could say we're fear mongering. Oh, they might just liquidate the entire museum collection. But number one, yeah, they've got these kind of legal fees. And again, membership is fading. And furthermore, that they changed this for a reason.
Right.
This is not just something that just happened. This was something that was orchestrated.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you figure it's 2023. They put that original one in place in 1989. So, that's 34 years ago. There's a reason. There's got to be a reason as to why that change was proposed now. And if anyone thinks that that change wasn't proposed, either at the request or outright direction of Wayne LaPierre, then I think you've got your head stuck in the sand. There's a reason to remove the oversight from that, and it's because someone told you to. I mean, it makes no good financial sense to have gun collectors not evaluating a collection, and to not have your finance committee evaluating the financial benefit of this stuff, unless someone's wanting to do something shady with it, right?
And it's also, let's not bury the lead. This is a museum. This is an exhibit that should be open to the public. And I've viewed many of the collections from this museum, and they've got some amazing stuff, and it's absolutely breathtaking to see it. And I've got nothing but fond memories of the NRA Museum, and to have that suddenly go from being what it is, which is, you know, both a, you know, both an exhibit to the public, but also an archive of all of these historical firearms, to being just a piggy bank to be flittered away however, you know, however they need it and what they can deal with, is frightening. And I don't think it's alarmist to think that that might be a realistic possibility.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is, the way I read that is, it says that, you know, Wayne could liquidate the entire collection. Do I think that that's going to happen? Probably not. But do I think some of the really high value 6-figure and 7-figure guns may disappear? You know, that wouldn't surprise me one bit. So, like you said, it's, I don't think it's fear mongering. I don't think it's sensationalism. This is what happens when you let the fox in charge of the hen house, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that that museum is not run the way a museum should run. I want everyone to understand that, you know, that what is going on at the NRA museum is not what you would see happen at other institutions, you know, at other museums. This is an oddity for certain. And no self-respecting museum person would ever stand for something like this going on. And so this is a byproduct of that museum not being run like a museum and not being run by museum people. And this is what you get when you don't value the collection as a whole and instead value it as individual pieces with monetary value attached to them. You know, that's the big thing that I always found interesting when I would give people tours of the museum. They'd ask me, they're like, "Oh, well, how much is that gun worth?" Well, for all intents and purposes, it's priceless because it's in this museum. It has an insurance value, but it doesn't have a resale value in that terms. And that's how you're supposed to look at museum objects. But this looks at them solely from a financial aspect, and that's just not how it's supposed to work.
Well, all right. Now, while you're talking about this and while my blood is running cold, my wheels are turning and I'm like, well, what can we do? What can we do? And stop me if anything I'm saying is wrong, but I'm seeing, all right, well, we can't really contact the NRA because we've been contacting the NRA constantly with all of the crap that they've been doing. And, yeah, they don't care.
No.
And I would argue that, well, this podcast is raising awareness, and I'm really just getting this out to raise awareness, and I think that's the most important thing to do. But at the same time, the big concern I've got is there are older people who've been collecting firearms for their lifetime who are getting towards the end of their life. And I had a very, very close friend who was a firearms collector, and his children never really got that into firearms, weren't that into guns. And luckily for him, he had me and his son-in-law, are both firearms collectors and firearms enthusiasts. And so, and he was overjoyed that, you know, suddenly there were people he considered family in his life that he could send his collection off to. And he knew that we would do exactly what the museum did, which was, when he passed away, me and his son-in-law got together and we divvied up the guns that we hadn't been given while he was still alive. But then divvied up the guns that were left over in his estate. And some of them were just practical guns that neither one of us had an interest to. And those got sold and they're moved off to loving homes. And then others are now in our private collections and are parts that we love. But if you know, you think about like some 80-year-old man that's in a nursing home, and you know, his wife, if he's still married, isn't that interested in it, and maybe doesn't have any kids that are interested in it. But are they going to be listening to podcasts? Are they going to be going on YouTube?
Right.
You know, how are they going to find out that their last dying wish, which was that they may have come up with in the 80s, was that, oh, when I pass away, none of my family seems to be that interested in it. When I pass away, I'm going to donate my guns to the NRA annual, you know, the NRA museum, and what pieces they don't choose to display, they will sell and use to preserve and or purchase nicer pieces.
Right.
And that's a noble wish, but
absolutely,
but they're not going to do it to pay Wayne LaPierre's lawyers to keep him out of prison.
Right, exactly. And that's, yeah, that is the problem. And I think a lot of people, especially really dedicated collectors, you know, they operate under the mentality of, you know, I literally spent my entire life putting together this collection, and I want other people to appreciate it the way I do, so I'm going to give it to a museum so that it's preserved in perpetuity. That is a noble cause, but what I always tell people is that no one cares about your collection as much or the way you do than you. You know, say you have an absolute complete type collection of Ivor Johnson pistols, you know, the little revolvers, and you spent your entire life collecting one of every single Ivor Johnson ever made. Is that really cool that you have a type collection of that? Absolutely. I think that's really neat.
Wicked cool.
Wicked cool. Right. But from a museum standpoint, does that collection, you know, is anyone else really going to be interested in an absolute complete type collection? Maybe one or two people. But if only one or two people are interested in it, that means that your entire collection is not going to go on display. Maybe one or two pieces that are in better condition than what are already on display are going to get switched out. But the majority of that stuff is either going to sit in a vault in storage waiting for some kind of potential use, or there is the possibility that those pieces could be sold to further benefit the museum collection. And that is all things that I think people need to understand, is that just because you give something to a museum, one, it doesn't mean that it's going to be on display. Two, it doesn't mean that if it's going to be on display, that it'll be there forever. And three, it doesn't mean that the museum has to keep it in perpetuity. Now, deaccessioning of pieces is something that should be done sparingly. And it is often said in the museum world that the best deaccession plan is a good accession plan, meaning that you don't have to deaccession what you didn't bring in the first place. So if you do a good job of truly curating your collection, then you don't end up with pieces that you don't need. But, you know, that life is not perfect, and that's not how things end up. And so it is written into every deed of gift that I've ever encountered in any of the museums that I've worked in, is that you acknowledge, you know, you get to take the tax write-off, but we now own the gun. You don't have any title to it anymore, and we can do with it as we see fit, up to and including selling it. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily read the fine print, and they don't understand that that is a possibility. But if they do understand that, I think the majority of people operate of the mindset that if the guns are going to be sold, it's going to be for a good and noble purpose that will benefit the museum, not to fill a shortfall in a budget for legal defense.
The one thing that I have thought of is, if you are part of a hunting club or a shooting club or a collector's club or something like that, that has people of all ages in it, pass this information along.
Absolutely.
You know, I know one of the board of directors of my gun club listens to the show, and I'm letting him know, hey, we definitely need to talk about this at the next club meeting, because there might be one or two people in there who might think that the NRA museum might be a good place for their collection to go to after their passing. And, yep. And yeah, that might not be the best idea. Well,
absolutely. Yeah.
Either way, let's hope we can do some good of this. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Logan Benesch of High Caliber History.
Thanks for having me.
So weird. Mm-hmm. Do you remember back in 2018 when a bunch of other gun bloggers and even some podcasters called us all sorts of names when we asked the very logical question, NRA, what the heck were you thinking due to their poor decisions and the poor optics on those decisions?
I do remember some people being very upset with us on our harsh mm-hmm. words.
And do you remember them jumping in and defending Wayne LaPierre and, you know, he's doing a fine job and we should trust him and we shouldn't question him?
I unfortunately remember that part as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're ever going to get an apology?
That breathing sound you hear, that's me not holding my breath.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah, that's the, I mean, I mentioned the at the end of the interview, a potential solution for this, but just, yeah, get the word out as best you can, especially in more, I guess you could say, traditional methods. Like, again, I think gun clubs will be a good place because, I mean, if people are hanging, if these are people that you're friends and you're hanging out with you, they already have heard you talking about the NRA and the issues on that. And so if they had an endowment in their will on their collection being donated upon their death to the NRA Firearms Museum, they probably already might have figured out a thing or two about that. But for people that may not have young whippersnappers who listen to podcasts for friends, or people who watch YouTube videos and all that for friends and close confidants, Put a note about this on the corkboard at your gun club or at your hunting club, or talk to your local gun shop and see if they can spread the word, because I'd hate to see someone, you know, years later pass away and donate their collection to the NRA Museum and realize that it may just get sold and used to, for all we know,
buy a new suit for Wayne.
Exactly. Buy a new is exactly where I was going. Buy a new suit for Wayne or get him a trip to fly to Dallas to be at this board meeting that could have been held in Fairfax. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's all. Just get the word out. Let people know that, this is some crappy shenanigans. And again, if they weren't planning on doing something crappy, well, why would they have done it at all?
I know of at least a few firearms clubs who previously made it a requirement to join the NRA in order to join the gun club. I'm not entirely sure what the reasoning was. It wasn't just because.
Oh, it's actually the set. There's actually an endowment with the NRA where actually you can petition them for money and they will pay, either give you money or actually supply labor to turn a plot of land into a shooting club. And the understanding being that that is an NRA club, therefore only NRA members can be admitted. And so you will have a lot of I remember actually hearing people, there's an NRA club, near my house up in Maine and hearing people complaining about the fact that they were liberal gun owners and did not like the NRA and weren't a huge fan of them, but they had to be an NRA member to be part of the club.
Well, a lot of those clubs are canning that particular requirement. And this was before the news of this museum fiasco came out. And so if you bring it up to your gun club, they may very well decide to do away with that. And honestly, I think the only way we will get the NRA's attention is through their pocketbook. I mean, I still remain doubtful because they're hemorrhaging money and they don't seem to be doing anything other than trying to liquidate. But yeah, maybe that'll get their attention. Maybe not. I don't know. I've pretty much, at this point, I've stopped trying to help the NRA and I have set up the lawn chair and I'm just watching it burn.
That is, I am well known for being a bit of a Pollyanna, but boy, there's been a whole lot of sturm and drang happening within the NRA of angry members and angry board members and various people that have been pushing back against Wayne LaPierre and just the general corruption within the NRA board of directors, and yet nothing's happened. So I, at this point in time, I don't foresee anything happening besides actual charges being left.
Well, as I've said before, Wayne knows where the bodies are buried, and so he's not going to be resigning. He will either leave in handcuffs or in a body bag.
Unfortunately, I think you're right on that, Aaron.
But you know who isn't going to be charged weird? Our patrons.
Yes, and we gotta say thank you to each and every one of our listeners, but a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. Ooh, they're good. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Over there, you can get an early release of the podcast, plus there's bonus content. We've got blooper reels. They are funny. We also have the ACP film tracks, and we have the ACP Magdump. That's our monthly unscripted, no-holds-barred show.
Telling someone that a blooper reel is funny is akin to when you're doing an impression and telling people who you are doing the impression of. If you have to tell people that it's funny, it's not funny.
Well, then... You're laughing, though. You are laughing.
Hey, my name is Weird Beard. I like 1911s and revolvers.
Sounds just like me.
It's uncanny.
That's my wife to say, "You think you're funny, aren't you?" as she's laughing. And I'm like, well, you're laughing.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
I got a blog. It's called weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And you can be weekly on Headgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can get more from me at linktree.com/AaronPillette. That's linktree.ee/AaronPillette. All one word.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
I want to drive a tank. I want to be a chick in a tank top. So please vote for me. And don't vote for Weird because he's not eligible for anything. Meh. Our coolness eligibility is assorted, and so is our podcast. It's a reach, but whatever. I'm having a good day. Good night, everybody.
Good night.